Why Fighting Terror Is Not World War III, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Last night, President Obama said terrorism does not threaten our existence. This expert agrees, and she blames the media for people thinking otherwise.
They don't put it in context, you know, within the realm of likelihood in which you have a better chance of being struck by lightning than being killed by a terrorist.
Also, this young Syrian doesn't want to fight for anyone. Not Assad, not the rebels, and not ISIS.
They are all them criminals. They hit the people.
Plus, Netflix expands in Africa, one monthly subscription at a time.
$7.99 is a lot of money to somebody living on $4 a day, but actually, that's not the whole story of Africa.
Those stories, today on The World. Glad you could be with us today. Let's begin with President Obama's final State of the Union address. There were a few moments last night when the whole Congress, Democrats and Republicans, applauded in agreement with the president. But America's fierce partisan divisions were definitely on display as well. Take the threat posed by ISIS. Here's the president.
They pose an enormous danger to civilians. They have to be stopped. But they do not threaten our national existence.
Now, here's the Republican position as laid out by South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in the official GOP response.
We are facing the most dangerous terrorist threat our nation has seen since September 11th. And this president appears unwilling or unable to deal with it.
Most dangerous threat since 9/11, or really not that bad? Mia Bloom at Georgia State University has studied terrorism for years. So, Mia, who's right? Is it World War III?
It's definitely not World War III. I think we have to understand what constitutes an existential threat. We look at existential threats, for example, when during up until 1991, the Soviet Union possessed the capacity to destroy the United States several times over with nuclear weapons, long range, short range. That's existential. A world war is existential in the sense that, you know, you saw both in the First and the Second World War where groups of states bonded together in order to destroy or overtake entire parts of Europe, North Africa, Middle East. That's not this.
The fear of ISIS, though, is real, right? And if it is real, then terrorism is working here on American shores.
Absolutely. You know, when we look at statistics, for example, 32,675 people dying in a highway accident in 2014, 33,500 people because of firearms, 17 people in 2014 were killed by terrorism. I think the fact is that it's become very much politicized. And so it becomes part of the rhetoric, both of the GOP, but also the Democratic Party, and people are focused in on it. And if the media is constantly saying terrorism, 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 that's one of the problems. They don't put it in context. They don't put it, you know, within the realm of likelihood in which you have a better chance of being struck by lightning than being killed by a terrorist.
Mia, is there any other consideration to the ISIS threat that you didn't really hear taken on directly by either the president or Nikki Haley last night?
No, I think Governor Haley was correct in one thing when she said, and I'm quoting, during these anxious times, it's tempting to follow the siren's call of the angriest voices, and we must resist that temptation. I think this is an indication that there are elements within the GOP that understand that the vast majority of American Muslims left countries to come to America for a reason and are extremely loyal Americans. The problem that we have to understand is that by using this kind of xenophobic rhetoric, that we actually might inadvertently be radicalizing the next generation of American Muslims. We have to understand that the American Muslim community is our greatest asset in fighting radicalization and is a bulwark against ISIS recruitment. We cannot do ISIS's work for them by handing them on a platter an element of the American people who we have alienated and segregated. So this is where I think in this one instance, both the GOP and the president are speaking with one voice, and I think that that's a good voice to speak with.
Mia Bloom, professor of communications at Georgia State University, thank you.
Thank you so much, Marco, for having me.
The United States isn't the only place debating the current terrorist threat. Europe, too, is on edge. Some worry that terrorists may be among the thousands of migrants still making their way into Europe. Our next story takes us into the lives of some of them along the Serbian-Croatian border. That's where Rebecca Collard met some young Syrians who say they're not terrorists. In fact, they're trying to avoid any kind of fight.
When Omar finished his geography degree, he had a difficult decision to make. Join the Syrian army or flee the country.
The army is controlled by Bashar al-Assad.
For Omar, fighting for President Assad was not an option.
They pushed me to escape from Syria, from the Syrian army.
Syrian men face a draft when they turn 18. If they're students like Omar, they have a small reprieve until they finish their studies.
When I finish my degrees, I am not a student. I can't escape from Syria.
Graduates only have a few months before they're conscripted and their names are flagged at checkpoints and border crossings. So Omar, which is not his real name, packed a few things and headed from his home in the government stronghold of Latakia to the Lebanese border. From Tripoli, he took a boat to Turkey, where he met his friend Karim, also not his real name.
I hate war. I hate war.
Here, Omar is telling his friend's story.
He was in the army and he escaped from the army, you know, in Homs city, Homs, you know. He was in the army for 2 years and he escaped from the army.
Karim wasn't lucky enough to attend university. He was drafted at age 18 and spent 2 years serving in the embattled city. But he didn't want to fight for a dictator whose forces have killed tens of thousands of civilians. So he fled to Turkey, sneaking through a field and across the frontier.
I don't have passport, I don't have anything.
He and Omar paid smugglers more than $1,000 each to take them by boat to the Greek island of Kos. From there, they headed north. I meet them outside a registration center in southern Croatia. They want to go to Belgium, where Omar hopes to get his master's degree. Both say they don't want any part in the violence that has engulfed their country. Most of the people here are young men, and images of thousands of young men streaming toward Western Europe have sparked fears that they will bring with them violence and extremism. But the young men I speak to say they're leaving Syria because they don't want to take part in the violence. And if they stay in Syria, they may not have a choice. Sami is from Aleppo, a city divided among Assad's forces, opposition groups, and ISIS. He's 18, so if he stayed, he'd be forced to join Assad's army. But if he dodged the draft, he'd have to join another armed group, like the Free Syrian Army.
I don't want to die in our country for who? For Bashar al-Assad or Free Army? All them criminals. Bashar al-Assad is criminal, the Free Army is criminal, ISIS is criminal, all them criminals. They hit the people.
When the conflict started in Syria 5 years ago, the country's army was a 300,000-strong force. Now, some experts estimate it could be just half that. In July, Assad admitted he's short on manpower. And Sami says those forced to fight for him are now sent to the front lines without proper training.
Some people go to the army and let them to go to fight without training. They didn't know how to catch the weapon and fight.
But Sami says he didn't leave just to avoid conscription. He says it's about having a chance at a future, something that seems increasingly bleak in Syria.
Because I want to have my future like everyone do. I want to study and work and have a family and work hard.
And for Omar and Karim, that future has started. Since we talked, they both made it to Belgium and are in the process of claiming asylum. I will leave the camp and start my new life, Omar wrote in a text message. People here are kind with us. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard.
U.S. relations with Iran have been tested sharply in the past 24 hours. Last night, Iran detained 10 U.S. sailors aboard a couple of Navy patrol boats in the Persian Gulf. Earlier today, Iran released them after determining the Americans had entered Iranian waters inadvertently. Barbara Slavin follows U.S.-Iranian relations closely. She's with the Atlantic Council in Washington and is the author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies.
The details are still coming in, but it appears that one of the American boats had a mechanical problem and that the Americans actually drifted into Iranian territorial waters where the Iranians picked them up, took them back to an island checked them out, gave them a meal, and then sent them on their way after some urgent telephone diplomacy between our top officials.
I mean, the last time something like this happened was in 2007 when Iran held British sailors for 13 days, and this seemed to be wrapped up in a few hours. Is that a sign of how U.S.-Iranian relations have evolved? Because that's kind of what John Kerry was suggesting.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, there are a number of factors. First, you know, John Kerry and Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, are on first-name basis. They've been talking to each other for over 2 years about the nuclear issue and other issues. So it's very easy for Kerry just to get, you know, Zarif. I don't know if he sent him a text message or called him on his cell, but he had no problem getting a hold of him. The other thing is that the Iranians are anticipating massive sanctions relief in just a couple of days. And I think they were determined, certainly the government determined, not to have anything get in the way of it. So that's another reason why this was resolved very quickly.
Yeah, that implementation day, as they call it, sounds like it's a moment no one really wants to scupper at this point.
Well, especially the Iranians, because they're going to get their hands on billions of dollars in frozen funds.
What do you think of the fact that Obama did not mention this incident at all in his State of the Union speech last night?
It would have been odd. I mean, first of all, it was on its way to being resolved. Secondly, it would have kind of struck a discordant note, shall we say, since Obama was in a sense bragging about his achievements, his foreign policy achievements. And one of the major ones is this breakthrough with Iran on the nuclear program.
There was, and apparently still is, a lot of chatter both in Washington and Tehran, and it sounds like all sides are kind of using this incident to their advantage. For each side, where is the political value in what happened?
Well, for the Iranians, actually, I think it was very welcome because they stumbled very badly just a week or so ago. You remember when the Saudis executed that Saudi Shia sheikh, Sheikh Nimr.
Right.
In Iran, the Saudi embassy and their mission in Mashhad were trashed by demonstrators who obviously had some sort of institutional backing, at least initially. And that was very embarrassing. It changed the whole focus of the story from Saudi human rights abuses to Iranian misbehavior. And so I think it's very important that the Iranians kind of rebounded from that by making sure that this incident was taken care of very quickly.
So a quick and happy conclusion to this incident. We've got to recognize, though, that the Persian Gulf has long been a focal point of tension for many different players. In terms of military strategy, what are we looking at right now in the Persian Gulf?
It's a very crowded place. You know, oil tankers, navies of many countries interacting. I think one of the things that would be useful is to have an incidents at sea agreement between Iran and the United States. All of these incidents are dealt with rather ad hoc. And, you know, what will happen when we don't have John Kerry and Javad Zarif to resolve these things? Last month, there were some incidents where the Iranians were test firing rockets a little too close to American ships. So, you know, they do need some more rules of the road. But thankfully, this incident ended quickly.
Could the Iran nuclear deal kind of presage some of those rules of the road? Are we likely to see more cooperation between, this is not exactly cooperation, but it was a happy end, between U.S. and Iranian military?
It's possible. Look, the Iranians have to get through some parliamentary elections at the end of February that are very sensitive. We have to see how the deal is implemented. The nuclear deal is implemented, I think, for a little while. But I'm hopeful, frankly, that Obama will try to send some American diplomats back to Tehran before he leaves office to staff an interest section in Tehran. That would be enormously useful.
Barbara Slavin with the Atlantic Council in Washington. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Not all lawmakers were on the same page last night with Obama's State of the Union, but at least they were all sworn in. Can't say that about the National Assembly these days in Venezuela. It used to be the domain of socialist president Hugo Chavez. When he died in 2013, he handpicked his successor, and the National Assembly remained the domain of the socialists. But that changed last month when voters handed the opposition a majority in the National Assembly. Now there's an ongoing political fight between the opposition and the socialist Chavista government. Earlier this week, the socialist-controlled Supreme Court waded into the mess and stopped three opposition lawmakers from taking office. Hannah Dreyer is in Caracas. She covers Venezuela for the Associated Press.
Venezuelans, I think, were pretty overwhelmed when the opposition won congressional elections on December 6th. Chavismo had never lost an election before that. And there was a sense that if the socialists could lose one election, the whole thing might start tumbling down. On the first day of Congress, the lawmakers were promising to get rid of now President Maduro within 6 months. And now they're just struggling to be able to pass laws again. So I think all over the country, there's been a realization that if you win 17 straight years of elections, it gives you a lot of power. And that doesn't just go away overnight.
So the National Assembly, are they getting any business done?
Right now, lawmakers are being pelted with tomatoes and firecrackers as they try to enter the building. Really, the only thing the opposition Congress has gotten done so far is redecorating. The new opposition speaker took down all the portraits of Chavez on his first day in office, and he distributed a video of himself waving goodbye to the portrait, saying, "Throw those things in the trash." And since then, it's just been a fight to be able to pass laws.
So could there be political paralysis in all of Venezuela from all of this?
Down here, the correspondents have a running joke about trying to keep the words policy paralysis out of our stories. It's definitely the key Venezuelan phrase this month. But the truth is, the country's been in policy paralysis for years, really since Chavez died. His successor, Maduro, gets most of his strength from his connection to Chavez's legacy. And so he hasn't wanted to change any of the policies that were in place when he took office in 2013. So we still have the same initiatives, even as the shelves go bare and crime increases to the point where there's an informal curfew. Kind of can't get much worse.
All right. You're not going to use policy paralysis, but I will. So policy paralysis. But would you also say that this is the first big crack in the socialist domination in Venezuela that started with Chavez?
It's an intense time down here because the opposition has this huge mandate from the voters that they've never had before. But the socialists still control every institution. And it looks like what we're going to get is a Supreme Court that's trying to dismantle the Congress. And Congress, meanwhile, is taking steps to fire the judges on the Supreme Court. It's like high noon. There's no telling which side is going to come out on top.
Venezuelans are confused, as you say. Do they have any kind of allegiance and kind of sense of how they want to go forward?
All of us reporters are at the Capitol today with the tomatoes being thrown. And the other big news in town is that there was a supermarket riot when a grocery got in dried beans, which used to be cheap and plentiful, and now you can't find them. Venezuelans, I think, are still very focused on trying to feed themselves and avoid getting mugged or kidnapped.
Basic daily life stuff they're concerned about.
Yeah, when you have to spend 6 hours just trying to get sugar and flour, there's not a lot of bandwidth to be following all the theatrics with Congress, the Supreme Court, and the executive.
AP correspondent Hannah Dreyer in Caracas. And I just don't want to leave without mentioning that if you were hearing a little whistling sound, tell us what that is, Hannah. It's fascinating.
The knife sharpener who walks up and down the streets and blows his whistle.
That's so old school. Hannah Dreyer in Caracas, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
We stay in Latin America for this next story. Nearly 8,000 Cuban migrants are currently stranded in Costa Rica. Since November, they've been trying to get to the United States, and today, some of them finally began the journey. Under a deal approved by 5 Central American countries and Mexico, 180 Cubans boarded a plane and flew to El Salvador. From there, they'll take a bus to Mexico. Then those Cubans will have 20 days to reach the U.S.-Mexico border and presumably be welcomed to the U.S. Doris Meissner is a former commissioner with the Immigration and Naturalization Service. She's now a fellow at the Migration and Policy Institute in Washington. How extraordinary is this agreement between those 5 Central American nations and Mexico, expediting the passage of Cubans to the U.S.?
It's unprecedented as far as I recall. It is a reaction to Nicaragua having closed its borders. Typically in the past and over past years, we've seen more and more Cubans coming through Central America, but that requires getting through Nicaragua. So the Central American countries have agreed among themselves because of this bottling up that was taking place in Costa Rica and probably back now into Panama to facilitate their travel to the U.S. The U.S. was not involved in this discussion. I don't have any idea what quiet back-channel discussions might be taking place, but this is certainly not, from a U.S. standpoint, a very positive development.
I mean, it seemed these countries were not just kind of trying to solve a backup problem, but they were moving mountains to find a solution for these Cubans. Why this big effort, do you think?
Well, I don't know. You know, maybe we have a little bit of a clue in statements that were made this morning by the foreign minister of El Salvador when the plane arrived in El Salvador, and that is that very strong statement about the contrast between the way in which Cubans are treated by the United States and the way in which Salvadorans and others from Central America are treated by the United States. Now, that's mitigated a bit by a new development also today, which is that the United Nations is going to help in Central America to establish refugee processing for Central Americans seeking to come to the United States escaping violence. But it is certainly the case that Cubans have been the beneficiaries since the Castro Revolution of a very special policy that applies only to Cubans, and that has been in contrast with all other nationality groups. That was particularly stark in the 80s and 90s in the contrast between the way Cubans were treated and the way Haitians were treated under U.S. law. And today, it is certainly fair to make the comparison that Cubans are treated differently from others from Central America.
Do you see a double standard?
There is a double standard, but it is a function of the Cold War. It is based on the assumption that Cubans are persecuted in their country and therefore deserve protection in the United States. Those things certainly were true at one time, but they are increasingly, well, they are definitely not true anymore now that we have opened up relationships diplomatically with Cuba and have travel back and forth. And so this is a big discussion that has to take place, a new negotiation, and I think it's inevitable as a result of the opening of relationships. Cubans, of course, know that this is likely to change, and so they are in much larger numbers making last-ditch efforts to get to the U.S. while it's still possible.
Doris Meissner, a former commissioner with the U.S. INS, and now she's a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. Doris Meissner, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Later, Malian music legend Kanja Kouyaté's latest album and the family of producers who made it happen here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the past year, Germany has welcomed more than 1 million migrants. But after the New Year's attacks in Cologne, some locals say no more.
We're fine with the people who are here, and they should have the right to stay here. But it's going to be a real problem if there's another 1 million coming this year.
That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Over the past year, Germany's played a leading role in welcoming migrants to Europe. In 2015 alone, Germany took in more than 1 million people. But that welcome might be wearing thin, particularly after those chaotic New Year's Eve scenes in Cologne, Hamburg, and other German cities. Hundreds of young women reported being groped, harassed, and robbed by throngs of young men, mostly from the Middle East and North Africa. And now the German government has announced plans to speed up deportations of migrants caught breaking the law. From Cologne, Jacob Resnick has our story.
New Year's Eve. The German tabloid Bild posted footage of crowds of people celebrating outside the main train station here in Cologne. This was the area where more than 500 women reported being harassed, groped, and robbed that night by throngs of young men operating in groups. The men have been described as mostly Arabs from the Middle East and North Africa. Dirk Stutzel owns an antiquarian bookstore just around the corner. He says he didn't see anyone being harassed, but he didn't linger.
I didn't like the atmosphere there because there was so many foreigners, young men, and they were shooting the fireworks, and this was hell of a cloud from this burning stuff, you know.
Authorities have been criticized for not having enough police on hand to protect the crowds. The city's police chief has since stepped down, and a heightened police presence in the area is now visible. Recently, riot police used tear gas and a water cannon to prevent a clash between a mass demonstration by Germany's far-right Pegida movement and counter-demonstrators. Pegida is largely considered a fringe political movement, but the German government is taking the public outcry seriously. This week, two ministers announced legislation to expedite deportations of migrants convicted of serious crimes, including sexual assault. Stutzel says that's a good idea.
Those guys who did this, they should be sent home, I think. But you can't generalize on any refugees. Most of them are peaceful people, and even in this crowd, there were peaceful people probably, but it was like a group dynamic.
And now there are concerns of a group backlash. In the past year, there have already been scores of arson attacks on refugee homes across Germany. And just this Sunday, four separate attacks on migrants of Middle Eastern and African origin were reported around Cologne's train station.
Wir werden alles in unseren Möglichkeiten stehende tun.
Police officials say they'll do everything possible to restrain criminals and those who try to take the law into their own hands. But some who arrived here in the past year say they can already feel the atmosphere changing since New Year's Eve. Ahmed Alian is a 28-year-old lawyer from the Syrian city of Raqqa, now the de facto capital of ISIS. He came 4 months ago and is now working odd jobs and borrowing money to help support his two younger brothers and a nephew who are in middle school. He says he's noticing a big difference, especially on trains. People glare at him for minutes at a time. It's hard to take, he says. He's now working to learn German, he says, not just so he can get a real job, but also to fit in better as an outsider. Just down the road in the city of Bonn, Alaa Houd is a 28-year-old from Damascus who arrived more than a year ago with his wife and toddler son. He's an observant Muslim, and he's troubled by those who blame the New Year's Eve mob behavior on religion.
When they say it's Islam or this religion or this nationality or Arab or this, and in any culture you find this, it's forbidden. If you put Islam aside, in any culture, always the woman is red line.
He says people are using these attacks as cover for their Islamophobia.
Maybe when they catch the guy and they will find he's a Christian but he's Arab, they will say, okay, maybe he's psycho or something like this. But when they found out he's a Muslim, this is Islam, it's wrong.
The government's vow to deport criminal migrants is designed to win over a public uneasy about absorbing a million refugees and migrants. It also comes as right-wing politicians seek to chip away at Chancellor Angela Merkel's centrist coalition government. Dirk Stutzel, the bookstore owner in Cologne, says he feels the country is nearing a breaking point.
We're coming to a point where we say it would be okay if nobody came anymore. We're fine with the people who are here and they should have the right to stay here. It's going to be a real problem if there's another million coming this year.
For The World, Jacob Resnick, Cologne.
Europe's not the only place, of course, wrestling with immigration. There's a big debate in this country about who should be allowed in and how many. But the attitude toward immigrants in the United States and Europe differs in significant ways, not to mention the different benefits each side of the Atlantic offers new arrivals. Nancy Foner is a sociologist at the City University of New York. She's the co-author of Strangers No More. It compares the challenges faced by low-income immigrants in Europe and the United States.
The U.S. sees immigrants as Americans in the making and expects them, and it's okay to hold on to your ethnic identity as long as these are additions to a fundamental American core. The U.S. accepts and even expects hyphenated identities. Many long-established Americans also think of themselves as hyphenated Americans, as Irish Americans or Italian Americans. And in many European countries, it's more difficult. The immigrants and their children may say, feel French, feel German, but often the Germans and French don't recognize them that way. And the Dutch even have a special category for non-Western Europe immigrants. They call them allochthones, which means that they're not people of the soil. And this is applied to non-Western immigrants and their children, even when they've been born in the Netherlands.
I mean, despite those hyphenated identities, immigrants to this country, immigrants to Europe, still feel alienated at times. What are the different pressure points in the U.S. and Europe where that alienation starts to set in for immigrants?
I think one of the big differences is in Europe. Religion, Islam in particular, is a major barrier for immigrants. And there's a big focus on the threat to Muslims undermining core values core democratic values in Europe. Of course, there are the worries about security threats, which have become even more heightened recently, right, in light of the Paris attacks. But this is on top of a longstanding fear that Muslim immigrants are threatening values like freedom of speech, gender equality, that they're going to ruin and overturn key values in European society. That's a very strong threat in European societies. And although, of course, in the U.S., there's a lot of anti-Muslim hostility, I don't want to minimize that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, don't you see that fear setting in?
Yes, and if certainly we see it in the Republican primaries that certain candidates are bringing that out. To the extent that there is anti-Muslim sentiment, a lot of it is focused on external security threats. And there are a number of reasons why that's true. One is that Muslims in the United States are a very tiny proportion of immigrants. They're about 4% of all immigrants in the U.S. are Muslim. If you look at European societies, 40% of immigrants from outside the European Union are Muslim. In the U.S., religion is more accepted. The U.S. is a more religious society. Western European societies have become very secular. Despite Western European secular societies, they have very deeply ingrained and almost exclusively Christian religious identities, so that the institutional context in many European societies continues to favor Christianity in many ways and to marginalize Islam.
When we talk about integration and making it in a new home country, who does better financially, low-income immigrants in Western Europe or the United States?
Poverty rates are higher among immigrants in the U.S. It's a kind of anomaly because there's higher labor force participation rates. Immigrants and their children are overwhelmingly working, but their poverty rates are higher.
I mean, some of what you're saying, Nancy, is expected. Some of it's counterintuitive. What people did you meet whose story surprised you?
Perhaps one thing that comes out that's surprising is that in the European context, there's a great deal of concern and worry about parallel societies, concern that immigrants are, as one person in Britain talks about, that they're sleepwalking to segregation. But in fact, rates of residential segregation are actually higher in the United States, particularly among Black immigrants, than we find in Europe, even for Muslim immigrants. One interesting thing, and something that I've done in the past as well as in this book, is to look and compare Afro-Caribbeans, who are very numerous in the Netherlands, in Britain, and France, and in the United States. And clearly, the rates of racial segregation for Afro-Caribbeans in those European countries much lower than what we find among Afro-Caribbeans in the United States. And the rates of intermarriage among Afro-Caribbeans and whites in these three European countries are very high, in some cases over 50%.
Doesn't that tell us something important about integration?
Well, it tells us that Black immigrants are having an easier time integrating, I would say, in many ways in Europe than in the U.S. And of course, European societies, they did not have slavery on their native soil the way the United States did. And so the United States has this very sordid history of racial inequality, and it affects Black immigrants who come here who are growing in numbers. They are 1 out of 10 immigrants.
So it's kind of hard to generalize about Europe right now, given the just huge flow of migrants this past year. But do you see integration getting harder for immigrants?
I think the pessimism in Europe is really a lot about Muslim immigrants and their children. You know, an unknown question is how will the massive immigration of refugees, how that is going to affect their societies? We don't really know yet.
Nancy Foner, professor of sociology at the City University of New York and co-author of the book Strangers No More. Thank you very much, Nancy.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Our next story is about a disease called cryptococcal meningitis, or crypto for short. It's painful and it's deadly. Crypto kills an estimated 300,000 people around the world every year. HIV/AIDS patients are particularly vulnerable to the disease. But now there may be a promising way to detect crypto. Newsweek's Patrick Adams has been shadowing a team of American doctors in Uganda who are testing out a new early detection device. I'd never heard of crypto, so I asked him to explain first what it is.
It's not surprising that you haven't heard of it. Many people have not. Cryptococcosis is a fungus. It's found in soil around the world. It could be found in Boston, could be found in Rwanda and Uganda. And cryptococcal meningitis is a disease that results from inhalation of those fungal spores. And it affects people who have HIV primarily, those who are immunocompromised. and therefore are vulnerable to what are called opportunistic infections, similar to tuberculosis. It used to be in Uganda, at the height of the AIDS epidemic, the face of AIDS. And that was because so many people got it. They would get a tremendous headache and would finally go into the hospital, and then they would be diagnosed with AIDS.
So tell me about this medical device. What is it exactly?
Well, it's great because it's a very simple device that functions much like a pregnancy test. So it's a dipstick. You dip a strip of paper into a fluid. It can be blood, it can be urine, and it can be spinal fluid. And you get an answer within 10 minutes. And it can be performed by a low-level health worker, not a doctor, which is important in poor countries because doctors are often scarce, like Uganda.
So patients, especially the HIV-positive patients who are being screened, you were with the doctors. Did you observe reactions to the screening process? What was that like?
Well, it's a laboratory test, so it's done sort of, you know, behind the scenes. And
yeah, so the patients aren't actually there observing while the screening is happening.
But I can tell you that when patients do come in with disease, and this is why this device is so important, because it catches them before they have disease. It can catch them months before symptoms occur, and you can successfully treat them in that period. Whereas when they come in with disease, they come in with raging headaches, and they have to get a lumbar puncture to relieve the pressure of fluid that builds up in their brain. It's an excruciating condition. So this test allows them to avoid that.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything to indicate so far that this screening, especially if it's HIV-positive patients who are being screened for crypto, that it may actually stave off full-blown AIDS?
In a way, yes. I mean, what you are doing really, I think, is giving AIDS patients who would have died, this is a highly fatal condition, another chance. So they have either not accessed treatment for HIV in the first place, or they've accessed it and stopped taking the drugs, either because of stigma or financial barriers to that. So for some reason, they've defaulted on their treatment, and now they're vulnerable to this condition. If you treat this condition, you can give them another chance to get on antiretrovirals and to survive.
How are the Ugandan medical workers responding to the introduction of this technology? Are they taking to it?
They absolutely are. They've embraced it. And I've visited smaller clinics outside of the capital where they were able to identify so many asymptomatic cases, patients who have the antigen or the marker of this disease in their blood, but who have yet to develop symptoms. And by catching them early, they can not only save their lives and improve their outcome, but they can also save on tremendous hospital costs.
So as you shadowed these American doctors, Patrick, what was the most memorable experience you had covering the story?
You know, I talked with one survivor named Rose Sabina. She had HIV and one day had a tremendous headache, and it grew and grew over the following days. At one point, her family, and this is not a unique story, locked her in a room because she had developed dementia as a result of this condition. And she was confused and in great pain. And they brought her to the hospital. And the doctors on this team wanted to give her a lumbar puncture. And there's an association in Uganda of the lumbar puncture or the spinal tap with death. People view it as a death sentence because in places where there is not good care, people die. She agreed to the lumbar puncture, and then she was treated as part of this research study and survived, and she was tremendously grateful. And you could just see, I mean, this is a person who would have died, absolutely would have died, without the treatment that is available through this study. She is an example of what you can do when you treat early enough to save somebody.
Newsweek reporter Patrick Adams speaking with us from Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco. I appreciate it.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Netflix, it made a big announcement recently. The online streaming service is expanding into an additional 130 countries, including in sub-Saharan Africa. Russell Southwood is the chief executive of Balancing Act. That's a consultancy specializing in telecoms and the internet in Africa. I got to say, given the politics in Nigeria, I'm really hoping there is a House of Cards Abuja that becomes a thing, because the Kevin Spacey version would pale, I think, in comparison. Is that where things are headed for Netflix?
Netflix, in fact, is covering the whole of the African continent, including North Africa. It's very, very early days for them. They kind of pre-signaled that they were going to come into South Africa, which is one of the bigger markets. At the moment, they're buying modestly in terms of content, it seems, as far as we can make out.
So just practically speaking, what does Netflix going into the African market mean for Africans? What will they get?
They will get pretty much the same international range of programming, both TV programs and films, that everyone else gets. In addition, they will have a gathering of films that will be both African in orientation and maybe even specific to their country. So if you're living in Nigeria or South Africa, you may well see movies from your own country. My guess would be that they have chosen a sort of select amount of African content to go with to start with, and they'll build that up slowly.
I mean, well, you've got countries like Nigeria and Kenya. They produce a lot of content. There are active kind of filmmaking industries going on there. Will this help those filmmakers and that whole infrastructure?
A company of the scale of Netflix coming in will hopefully drive a process of professionalization. At the moment, there is an increasing demand for African content, not least because Africa is making the transition to digital broadcasting and the number of channels is increasing.
So $7.99 a month for Netflix. A lot of people in Africa live on $3 a day. That seems like a lot of money to shell out for streaming. Why is Netflix going into the African market?
It, like many others, can see the future is in places like Africa. I think that $7.99 is a lot of money to somebody living on $4 a day, but actually that's not the whole story of Africa. Africa also has, in a number of countries, a reasonably large middle class, and therefore those people will have little or no difficulty paying. You're already talking about several million people already pay for pay TV services on the continent, so there's a willingness to pay there. And amongst the middle class, that sort of money is not always easy to find, but is one of the things that people tend to find money for.
Even among the wealthy, there seems to be an obvious catch, and that is this is a snazzy new technology introduced to some places where there's severely outdated infrastructure. Rolling blackouts are a daily event, if not an hourly event. It's not a winning combination, is it?
There is a very real problem with both network speeds and the cost of bandwidth and reliability in general. But the arrival of somebody like Netflix, in a sense, asks all those who are involved in providing bandwidth of this kind to up their game. I spoke recently to a colleague in Zambia who was telling me that he had bought a fiber to the home connection from a company in Africa called Liquid Telecom. He has given up his pay TV subscription and now streams all the content he wants to see on this fiber connection. So it's not impossible to do, and that's the future we're all hoping for.
So with Netflix going into Africa, going to Latin America, will I be able to see like Nollywood dramas now from Nigeria or Latin American telenovelas? I mean, that would be very interesting for a lot of the diaspora living in this country.
I think you'll find that there will be a range of different African programming, and the diaspora will be the first people to watch it, and then some small part of that content will be watched by other people.
Russell Southwood, Chief Executive of Balancing Act, that's a consultancy specializing in telecoms and the internet in Africa. Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me.
If Netflix needs some ideas for movie plots, our final story today would be a good start. It's about one great singer from Mali and two generations of record producers from neighboring Senegal. Here's a singer, a legend in Mali and many parts of West Africa, Kanja Kouyaté. The producer of Kouyaté's latest recording, which made my top 10 list for 2015, had been Ibrahim Sila. He was the founder of Sila Arts, one of the best-known record labels in post-independence West Africa. Sila had produced several albums with Kouyaté, and in 2011, Sila was hoping to get Kouyaté back into the studio to produce what would be her first recording in more than 10 years. But Kouyaté was still weak from a stroke she had in 2004. Still, Sila was determined.
He still believed in Kanja, despite illness.
That's Bintou Sila, Ibrahim's 27-year-old daughter.
He was also sick, and maybe he was thinking at this time that it was the last chance for him to record an album with this artist. So I think all these things make that they record this album.
As she says, her father was sick when the session with Kouyaté started, and midway through, producer Ibrahim Sila died. Bintou picked up her father's baton and completed the album for him. But Bintou didn't just do it for her father. She also recognized the importance of Kanja Kouyaté's music. Kouyaté, she says, is one of the last living connections to an ancient musical tradition in West Africa.
Kanja Kouyaté, she comes from the great tradition of Djeli, the last singer, the last Malian and Mandingo singer who know perfectly the art of the Djeli. It's why she is so important.
Even among the Djeli poets, troubadours, and griots, Kanja Kouyaté has distinction as an Ngara, a singer who possesses an aura of majesty. Do you worry that this might be her last album, given her health?
No. I don't think that she's going to finish her career. I think that it's a new beginning. It's also why I choose this title of this album. It's a new begin.
The title of Kouyaté's album is Renaissance, or Rebirth. It's both a hope and an assertion, because it really doesn't sound like Kanja Kouyaté is retiring anytime soon. Here's more from Renaissance and Kouyaté's song Dakolo. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories and music from around the world.
PRI, Public Radio International.